So, if you are watching this, and let me make sure the mic is working. Yeah, if you are watching this, I'm going on a walk with my dog. No one's on yet, so I'll start paying attention for real once people show up. But it's happening right now. All right, we have one person on the chat. One person. Dog, please give me a sec. Dog will be seen shortly. Oh, okay, 35 people. All right, great. Am I really quiet? How you doing? I'm doing good. Okay, so if you are joining, there's a lot of you now. If you are joining, I'm taking my dog for a walk. It's nice outside. It's cloudy. Usually August in Virginia is miserable, but it's a nice pleasant day outside. Humid, but I can live with that. So we're walking the dog, who needs a good walk. I need a good walk. I've been kind of with my kids all day. Now, I love them very much, obviously, and we've been just doing a lot of activities, and I need the quiet. I also wasn't able to go work out this morning or yesterday because of childcare, so I need the exercise too. People wanted a photo of the dog. That will be coming shortly. This is an extremely lightweight seersucker jacket from Buck Mason. Like, it's basically, there's like almost nothing there. So, I like wearing jackets. I feel comfortable in them. All right, real quick, dog. So that's Angelica. You may have seen her in the corner of some videos, in some streams. She is a hound mix, many, many kinds of hound. I forget the number one. My wife did like a dog DNA test, and she has one particular dominant hound, and then it's beagle, which, yeah, very obviously some beagle in there. And then someone asked me, how do I feel about being a style icon? Am I an Ivy style icon? I don't think of myself as one. I just wear what I like to wear. Although I say that, like, I don't think about it, like think about what I want to wear quite deliberately. I very much do. I have a couple books on Ivy style of various kinds. You know, the ones that people have, Black Ivy, that kind of thing. And I do, you know, I look at catalogs and I do think about how I want to dress and present myself. Quite deliberately. But I don't think of myself as a style icon. What do I think of the idea of an NIH for open source tech work? I think it's a great idea. I am a firm believer in, as much as possible, first building up state capacity to do serious tech digital work. And then in addition to that, you know, making like actual digital products. The US Digital Service was that, right? But Trump dismantled it. Programs like the IRS's Direct File, a version of this that Trump, again, dismantled. But it's a good idea. Sorry, I was gone for a sec. For those of you who said you've been reading me since 2014, when I was a wee journalist, no, thank you, appreciate that. I was 27 in 2014, believe it or not. 27, feels like a lifetime ago. Any recommendations for Yaphet Kodo performances? Yes, I love his performance in Across 110th Street, which is just a fantastic movie. One of the great blaxploitation films. Actually, honestly, less a blaxploitation film than sort of like a gritty crime film, but it's so good. For a weird Yaphet Kodo performance, you're gonna look for Bone, where he plays this like home invader. And he's great in Alien. I mean, he's great in everything. I did some years ago, after he died, a retrospective for Criterion. I don't know if you can find the video where I just talked about Kodo as an artist, as an actor. It was a lot of fun. One of my favorites. Yes, Blue Collar, of course. Blue Collar is a phenomenal film. Paul Schrader directed, stars Harvey Keitel, Richard Pryor, and Yaphet Kodo. One of the great films about working class life in the United States. Highly recommended. And one of the few films that really gets the racial dimensions of this quite well. God, I love that movie. What are my favorite movies in my collection? I have a lot of movies. And all my favorites are like, you know, I mean, it's like genre stuff. I love Hard Target, which actually has a phenomenal 4K transfer. It looks really good. I have lots of Batman movies, and I like all of them very much. A more serious movie that I love, Night of the Hunter, Charles Laughton's first and only picture as a director. Phenomenal. The Last Temptation of Christ. Maybe my favorite Scorsese, the one I at least come back to a lot. Peter Gabriel score for that is incredible. I was about to say phenomenal, but I think I've said that too many times. Yeah, I don't know. Michael Mann's Black Hat director's cut. I wish there would be a Miami Vice 2004 4K director's cut. There is a Manhunter edition coming out soon that I need to pick up. I'm a big Michael Mann fan. Big Jean-Pierre Melville fan, big influence on Mann. And my Le Samurai 4K is a prized possession. I like that movie very much. Do you think that the anti-Canadian rhetoric will persist in the Republican Party after Trump is gone? I hope not. I really hope not. I really hope that's a Trump thing that goes away when he's gone. I've said this before, I did a video on this, but the way that we've treated our Canadian and Mexican neighbors is just disgraceful. Two of our closest trading partners, two of our closest foreign policy partners, you know, we share histories, and we've treated them so terribly, Canadians especially. So a lot of work to rebuild that relationship. And if Canadians just said they're not really going to trust the U.S. again, I think that's completely fair. I'm a huge, this is the question, I should read it. I'm not nearly as well-rounded a movie fan as you are, Jamel, but it does enthuse me knowing you're such a movie buff. I love movies, man. You know, I don't read a ton of fiction. My fiction fix I mostly get from watching movies. And when I'm like really on a streak. I'll watch a movie a day. Last week, I think I watched four. on the same day, I watched Minions and Monsters, took my kids to see it, which was actually a lot of, really fun. Like, I have no opinions about the Minions, I've just mostly ignored it, but I really enjoyed Minions and Monsters, which was this wonderful homage to classic Hollywood. Kind of recommend it. And then that night, I watched History of Violence, the Cronenberg film. I'm trying to make my way through all of Cronenberg's work. I got stuck on Crash for like 4 months. I just was like, do I want to watch this? I did watch it. I did enjoy it. My wife came in at the point where, there are many points during that movie. You can come in and your reaction can be, what are you watching? But she came in during one of those points. And then I watched Existenz last week, which was fine. Interesting that like Existenz, Dark City, and The Matrix all come out basically within a year of each other. Something in the water, I guess. My main thought about Existenz was that had I seen that movie at the age of 12, Jennifer Jason Leigh would have permanently imprinted on my brain. Any thoughts on the Wisconsin primary? That's the question. I mean, my basic view right now is that the national political environment for Democrats is such that strong candidates are probably going to win across the board. How you doing? And even weak candidates are gonna make their way in. And I would put Hong, as far as being a general election candidate, on the weaker end of things. She just doesn't seem that deft. But we'll see, you know? We'll see. I think if she can figure out that she's not running in Madison and is running in the whole state of Wisconsin, she'll be all right. Chill, chill. Tallarico. I'm not awkward walking around with a selfie stick at all. Who cares? Tallarico is a very strong candidate, I think. And the interesting thing, I've said this before, but that he's not yet trailed in a poll against Paxton. He's broken 50% in a couple polls. He is highly rated across all issues compared. He has performed than basically any Texas Democrat the last 20 years. I think he's going to win. I am walking my dog, yes. Someone asked that there's concern of DSA infiltrating black communities. I don't know what that means. What does infiltrating mean in this context? Like, pretending to be black? I don't think that's happening. I think DSA attempting to reach out to black voters, meet them on their own terms, and try to build connections is good. I think that there is a bigger appetite for, you know, left-wing populism among black voters than people think, and that building trust and connections will be the important part of winning elections if you want more progressive policy. So, yeah. Are you walking on my dog? Yes, walking the dog. Trust me, brother, I know the pain. No pain for me. I like walking my dog. I understand the pessimism with regards to Texas, but I do think, I mean, this is where a lot of you, I feel, are skeptical or disagree or even say that I'm naive, which I find actually very risible, which is that I'm a firm believer that you do have to pay attention to the data and that your senses and intuitions should not get too far ahead of what just like measurements are telling us. And the measurements are imprecise, right? The measurements aren't perfect, but that's why we get lots of different ones and we try to build a picture from that. And the clear picture from Texas isn't that Tallarico is a shoo-in. It is that he's ahead. By any measure, he's ahead. Doesn't mean he's gonna win, but at this moment, he is ahead. And given the relative quality of the two candidates, Tallarico is just a better candidate on kind of a nuts and bolts level than Paxton. And given the national environment, and given the odds that things are more likely to get worse for Republicans than better, I'm willing to say that if I had to choose, if I had to bet money, you asked me to put $100 down on it, on my Poly Market, I would put money on Tallarico. What's my take on low trust between black communities and DSA progressives? I mean, to the extent that it's low trust, it's just like a lack of familiarity. A lack of investment by national progressives, I'd say. You know, when the calendar for the 2028 primaries came through, and you had lots of progressives, especially in media, complaining that South Carolina is first, saying that, oh, well, that just means it's trying to stop progressives and stop the centrists. You know, you can't win these conservative black voters. That kind of stuff does engender distrust and bad blood. And I think you shouldn't do it. And the other thing I'd say is that, like, and this, two things are true. I'm going to say, put it this way. Two things are true. First thing that is true is that black voters are not uniformly or categorically or axiomatically hostile to progressive policies. If you look at what the kind of policies they say they want, black voters tend to be more liberal, more progressive, however you want to put it, than your typical Democrat, even those black voters who say they are conservative, tend to favor more liberal policies than their white counterparts. There's a whole bunch of literature in the world of political science about how ideological identification among black voters does not work the way it does with white voters. White voters, or rather black voters, are not simply palette swapped white voters. And so things like church attendance and conservative identification don't translate to conservative policy views in the same way. Which gets to the second thing that is true, which is that I think it's true that progressives in the Democratic Party don't have enough familiarity with black voters, that the relative whiteness of kind of progressivism, left-wing Democratic organizing the past decade is a disadvantage because it just produces a lack of familiarity. And so like things I just said, right, that you cannot assume that because black voters call themselves conservative, or many of them do, therefore, they have no interest in progressive politics. You can't make that assumption. That's something that you could figure out from reading the literature or just by being around a lot of black people, you know? And the reason I think South Carolina being first is good for progressives is because it's a strong incentive just to start to do the work, to build the roots, to gain the familiarity, to build the connections and relationships. Because I think it's possible. I think it can be done. But you have to go in with like some humility, you know, and a recognition that you have to persuade people. Would I put $2,000 on Tallarico asking for a friend? Don't gamble. I have a video that I recorded and never published because it wasn't very good. But I'm like very anti-gambling and sports betting. And if it were up to me, you could not do this on stuff on your phone. I would outlaw it and go back to the time when if you wanted to gamble, you had to go to like a physical location, preferably one that made you feel bad about yourself. People are commenting about my dress. This is just how I dress. These are just the clothes that I wear. You have said that you want ICE agents to be prosecuted for the many crimes they commit. You believe that rank and file military personnel should be likewise to be prosecuted for committing war crimes. That is, I mean, yes, but that's a much harder lift, I'd say, a much heavier lift. There's a lot of discretion given to the military. I think your best bet in that regard is opening up inquiries into commanders, people who gave the orders, and then pursuing military discipline, like discipline from within the military, dishonorable discharges, that kind of thing. For ICE, I think criminal prosecution would be hard too, which is why I also think a minimum should be a bill that opens up civil liability for immigration enforcement officers, up to and including policymakers like Stephen Miller. Hell yeah, Peggy Flanagan. Do I know of any politicians in Washington who actively read my work? No idea. I got no clue about that. I'm sure if I asked around, I could figure it out, but I really don't know. How much is the narrative around black voters being reticent to support progressives a narrative generating bias by the mainstream media? I mean, I think it's just lazy thinking. I really think you cannot overstate laziness among press coverage. And it's like a very easy narrative, right? Left-wing candidates, young, white, college-educated, establishment candidates attract older voters, black voters, and there's your narrative. And it takes, you know, effort in reporting to maybe come to different set of conclusions. Do you think there will be an actual Nuremberg-style reckoning in the future for this administration? I'm personally very pessimistic. I mean, I'm probably pessimistic too, but that's why, you know, one of the things I think is my responsibility is to keep making the argument for doing these things, encouraging people to make that a political position, right? Something that you pressure lawmakers with, and then also offer ideas for how it can be done. I didn't really have time to write this week. I'm kind of half off at the moment. But one thing that I do want to write about is how key to getting accountability is taking the fetters off of the House and decentralizing the House. For those of you who are not institutional history sickos, one thing about the House is that for most of its history, it was an incredibly decentralized institution. committee chairs held most of the power, and subcommittee chairs held broad leeway. Beginning in the 90s with Gingrich and continuing on to the present, there's been radical centralization of authority in the House and the leadership. Put it this way, in the 60s and 70s, the Speaker was important, but not that important. These days, the Speaker is the most important person in the House, bar none. Back in the day, chair of the Rules Committee was probably the single most powerful position in the House, because the Rules Committee determined what would go on the floor. And if the members of the Rules Committee, or just the chair of the Rules Committee, did not like a bill, it just died right there. Rules Committee now is subordinate to the Speaker. So, one consequence of this is that there's just much less member initiative, you know? Much less for members to do. And I think that changing that matters for accountability for this reason. If you can devolve authority back down, and especially strengthen the subcommittees again, give subcommittees leeway, staff, resources, and kind of let them do their thing, that opens up all kinds of avenues for accountability. Give AOC a subcommittee over the Oversight Committee and say, you know, here's some staff, go at it, do what you want. And she might go digging, right? Oversight becomes much more creative in that world versus how it is now, where oversight is subordinate to basically election year messaging. But what you want is for, in the words of Chairman Mao, you want 1,000 flowers to bloom. And the only way you're gonna get that is really decentralizing the House. So I'm gonna write this eventually, but like, I see my job in part as making these kinds of arguments, saying these things to you folks, and then putting it in the air as much as possible and as frequently as possible. How many hats do I have? Too many, like 80. In my rotation, a lot. please, one more menswear question. We never get to see your shoes. Are you a loafer guy? Camp mocks, boots, sneakers? That's a great question. I am in this order. I like a good moccasin. I love a Blucher mock, which is, I'll have to show you a picture of them. But it's like, it's not quite as casual as a camp mock or a boat shoe, but it's not like a weird hybrid formal casual thing. It's like right in the middle. It's more structured, you might say, and I like them a lot. So mocks, then loafers, then sneakers. I actually have a lot of sneakers. And if I'm like wearing just like a pair of chinos and a popover and like a casual jacket or a chore coat, I'll throw on a pair of sneakers first and foremost. But I wear a lot of loafers. I have a lot of loafers. I can't answer the question about my colleague, even if he seemed to be my former colleague. I think Hong's, this is back to questions about Wisconsin, likely Wisconsin Democratic gubernatorial nominee, Francesca Hong. I think that although Hong does lack deftness, I think that that's something that she can improve on. And you're already kind of seeing it. I watched her, and this will be in a video I'm gonna record at some point. You watched her answer a question about like, you know, whether would Wisconsin voters go for her extremism by bouncing it back and saying, you know, my opponent, Tiffany, is the one with the truly extreme vote view is election denialism, wanting to take healthcare from Wisconsinites. That's the exact right counter to that kind of question. And if she can like figure that stuff out, right, you know, figure out how to deflect these things, next time she gets a question about, you know, canceling Thanksgiving, she should be able to laugh at herself and say, yeah, that was kind of silly. I was just frustrated with the situation. And I was frustrated because of the poor leadership of the president, poor leadership that my opponent Tiffany wants to bring to Wisconsin. Boom, easy answer, and you move on. If she can figure out that kind of stuff, I think she'll be fine. A two-party system is unacceptable. You got to take your, the issue is the rules, the structure. You got to change the structure to change the system. I really wish people would understand that and focus their energy away from independent candidates and third parties and towards structural changes to American elections. I'm gonna hold on for a second, another dog coming this way. Ange, come on. Seattle just reelected. All right, I'm gonna. Let's see. Wondering if you think your background studying religion in college has had an impact on your political commentary and approach to topics. I think it has, mainly in that I do take people's beliefs much more seriously than I think some left commentators are inclined to. There's still this tendency to just like do the whole false consciousness thing. People are being fooled, that kind of thing. And I don't think that's the case. I think people tend to believe what they believe sincerely. They really do think that. They may not have thought through it in a systematic way. They may be loosely held beliefs. They may be beliefs whose salience varies depending on situations and context, but they're real beliefs and you have to take them seriously. I think studying religion has really impressed upon me that people believe sincerely all kinds of crazy things. And you just have to take that seriously. What do I think is an appropriate size for the Supreme Court and the House? I'll answer the House first. In theory, the House should be like 50,000 people, right? In practice, I'm not really sure how useful that is. And this is, you know, this is one of my views. I do think that the kind of, we'll call it substantive representation that's possible with a smaller legislative body, meaning that individual members can develop real expertise and operate in a truly autonomous way, I think that's valuable. And so I would say that the House needs to be expanded, but like at 200 members, I think does the trick. I think it's bad for reasons previously offered. Oh, neat. Is that a hawk? Sorry. I got distracted by a bird. We got a lot of red-shouldered hawks around here. This might be something else, but it is a hawk. All right, back to size of the House. What was I saying? 200 members, and with the Supreme Court, I think there should be as many justices as there are circuits. So right now that being a minimum of 13 justices, but I think there should be more circuits and more district courts. So what I would do for expansion is double the number of circuits, double the number of district courts, and stagger new justices with every term, a president getting the pick four until you fill them up. Stefan, all of the construction I just walked by is public housing. What do I think of Senate Dem candidates dropping out in Idaho, Nebraska, and South Dakota to clear a path to independent candidates? I think they should do it. Winning is more important. And if a Democrat can't win in those states, then independent is better than a Republican, especially if that independent is going to caucus with the Democrats. No, so term limits, conversation about term limits happening. Term limits do in fact empower lobbyists. We have empirical data for this from states that have implemented term limits. I also think it follows logically. The thing about long-serving members is that they can develop expertise. Their staffs develop expertise, they develop knowledge. When you have frequent turnover, what ends up happening is that the locus of expertise, and especially if you don't have within the legislative chamber the kind of long-standing institutional capacity for research and policy development, which Congress currently really does not have. And I think that if you're going to do term limits, you'd first want to build that up again, really take seriously the creation of basically an administrative state within the legislature. But in the absence of that, the locus of expertise moves away from members and their staffs and towards the only other people who can be there for a long time, and that is lobbyists, who I think it's important to say tend to be genuine experts in their areas of expertise in the industries they're lobbying for. That's in part what makes them persuasive. The other thing about lobbyists I think it's important to understand is that I'll make this point by way of analogy. Not analogy, but by way of reference. In The Wire, Clay Davis famously says, I'll take anyone's money if they're giving it away. I'll take any motherfucker's money if they're giving it away, actually. But this is a family-friendly stream. And taking one's money for Davis did not actually bind him to any particular action or choice. If you're giving it away, he's going to take it. And something similar works with lobbying, which is at first, members will take money and then just do nothing. Nothing stopping them from doing that. But more importantly, lobbyists don't lobby members who aren't already receptive to being lobbied. You know what I mean? Lobbyists lobby members. They build relationships with members who, for ideological or constituent reasons, are already primed to listen. And what the lobbyists are doing is not persuasion, it's sort of bolstering, right? It's saying, you're already inclined to do this. I'm going to give you a bunch of smart reasons for continuing to do it. So it's like a pharma lobbyist is going to target a member who represents a medical device manufacturer, a member who represents pharmaceutical employees, right? This is not to say that lobbying is innocuous, it's not. But like, I think if you want to reduce its influence, you kind of have to understand the mechanism by which it works. And it works through the building of relationships and, you know, targeting people who are already inclined to agree. And you can't ban lobbying. That's a violation of the Free Assembly Clause of the Constitution. If you and your friend go to Congress to meet with your congressperson and ask them to take action on a thing you care about, you have engaged in lobbying. So, I mean, I think there are ways to limit the influence of lobbyists. And the big ones, and this is the stuff that people hate, the big ones are, again, increasing Congress's capacity to do research and policy making, increasing the size of congressional staffs, increasing the pay for congressional staffers, and honestly, if you really want to reduce the incentive of money, increasing pay for Congress members as well. You know? If after leaving Congress, you do not have to worry about trying to get like a corporate board job, then you're gonna be less inclined to listen to these people. But no one wants to hear pay members more. It makes people very angry. But I think that if you're thinking rationally about this, those are the solutions, more resources. Once you recognize that, like, what lobbyists bring to the table are resources. Again, I'm going to say you probably cannot ban lobbying. It is very much a free speech, free assembly, freedom of petition, all three things in the First Amendment. Very much one of those concerns. But the other thing is that corporations lobby. Civil rights groups lobby, unions lobby. You know, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And again, you really have to listen to this point I'm making. The most effective lobbyists are not going after people who don't already agree with them. How are you going to ban paid lobbying? Like, a lobbyist, a paid lobbyist, someone who's employed by an industry association to go petition. I mean, you know, working class pay isn't determined by Congress. We should raise the minimum wage, certainly. But another one of those sort of like things people don't like to hear is that something like 2% of workers actually get paid the federal minimum wage. Like, not very many people get paid it. I think you should raise it to create a national floor for wages, right? So first you would bid up state level minimum wages, and you would increase the upwards pressure on wages across the board. But like, even in that world, not that many people are gonna get paid the federal minimum wage. It's funny how it works out. But so I wanna be clear about this. I think we should raise the federal minimum wage. I think it will have good effects on wages for working people. But wages for working people are not primarily determined by the federal minimum wage. They're shaped by it, influenced by it, but they're not determined by it. I mean, the other thing, just back on the lobbying conversation, is, and this is an analytical thing I think people need to take seriously, is that, like, you actually cannot treat corporations as an indistinguished mass. Healthcare is a really good example. Pretty good, how you doing? Different organizations, different groups, different institutions, different interests have different interests. And so, doctors and hospitals are sometimes in conflict. Right? Insurance companies and hospitals might be in conflict. And like part of like politics is like playing these groups against each other. This is housing. You know, one of my frustrations with a lot of housing conversations is everyone lumps up, you know, developers and landlords and all these people in a single basket. But like the interest of developers, which is building housing in order to get returns on loans, like building housing to make money, are in direct tension, I say opposition, with the interest of landlords who have a direct interest in limiting the supply of new housing to increase the rents, and are in tension with the direct interest of just homeowners who want limited supply to increase the value of their homes. tenants, by virtue of wanting lower rents, have their interests will converge with builders and developers before they converge with homeowners and landlords. That's not to say that developers are good, but that the different, they represent different factions of capital, you know? And you have to like take that seriously and utilize that to get the outcomes that you want. So for example, a municipality that wanted to do a public building program could probably get buy-in from local developers, even as they struggle against local homeowners to change zoning regulations to make all that new building feasible. All right, on my way home, about to hit the house again. So this is gonna wrap up very soon. I mean, higher property prices would benefit you because you could take loans out against the equity. It's liquid, it's liquidity, basically. It gives you greater liquidity. Now, if you're like me, I am a homeowner, I don't really care. I'm not really interested in that. I didn't buy my house as some kind of investment, but that would be the reason. You can borrow against the money. You can borrow against the value of the home, basically, at like really favorable rates. All right, I'll answer one more question. Do I have a favorite Looney Tune? Foghorn Leghorn. Thoughts on getting higher private sector participation in unions? I think we probably have to rethink the entire mechanism structure for bargaining in this country. The NLR, the National Labor Relations Board, the NRLB settlement from the 1930s just isn't working. What that looks like, I've always been a fan of sectional bargaining, right? In which industries are, in which entire industries are organized like by industry, right? I've been a fan of mandating worker representation on corporate boards, so that in addition to the interest of shareholders, you have to consider the interest of workers. And I also think that there should be more incentive for the kinds of alternatives to traditional either public-driven companies or privately owned firms. I think co-ops, worker-owned collectives are things to pursue. There's a great book by G.A. Cohen, I think. I'll have to look it up. But it's just thinking about how can you realize socialism in actuality. And the thing he suggests is you look for the gaps in capitalism. And those are the places where you start doing your little experiments and widening the space for alternative means of organization. And so a market society like ours, where there are lots of worker-owned firms, is that capitalism? Is it socialism? I don't know. It's like it's capitalism with some socialist characteristics, and looking for the ability to do that, I think is good. Okay. Oh, I'll answer this one. Why does media discourse around extremism always focus on Democrats and progressives as opposed to Republicans? Stay tuned for my next video.